Business and Economic Development, meeting date January 28th, 2005, at 10 a.m. at the Hillsborough School District. The chair is Senator Rick Metzger.
We'll call the Senate Committee on Business and Economic Development to order, and welcome members and those in the audience for attending our first legislative hearing away from the Capitol, in which the members will actually be participating in legislation, and we're pleased to be the first committee to do that. There'll be another one this afternoon in Portland, but we definitely wanted to be the first. And we're here, and we're glad that you all here as well from the school. I know you have the day off. I know you have to attend a meeting, so I know this is a part of a requirement for you, but I hope it's going to be interesting for you as well. And as we talk about some of these issues, if you would like to testify on that, you're certainly going to be welcome to do so, and we'd love to hear your perspective. I think the first thing I'd like to do is introduce to all of you the members of the committee, and we also have a member of the House of Representatives from Missouri who has joined us for this hearing today. And with that, I would like to first introduce Teresa Van Winkle, who is the committee administrator for the Senate Business and Economic Development Committee, Mr. James Golden, our assistant with the committee as well. And then I'll turn it over to Senator Monis Anderson to tell us a little bit about the area she represents.
I'm Lori Monis Anderson, senator from Gresham, Wood Village, Troutdale, and Fairview. I'm a freshman senator this time. I've spent two sessions in the House, and I'm a nurse by trade, have been a nurse most of my professional life, and grew up in the Gresham area. And actually, I know most of you are from Hillsborough High School, and I graduated from Gresham High School.
Thank you. So let's go on the very end here. We have a guest on the committee today.
Yeah, I'm Representative Chuck Riley, and I'm from Hillsborough. My boys graduated from Glencoe, so maybe your rival, huh? Anyway, I represent the district that is Forest Grove, Cornelius, and a big portion of Hillsborough. I'm a freshman this year, having just won election in November, and I'm happy to be here. Thank you, Senator, for inviting me.
Thank you, Representative, for coming. And the Vice Chair of the Committee, and your Senator, Senator Brewster.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and welcome committee members that aren't from Hillsborough to Hillsborough. My district, Senate District 15, that I represent, represent the communities of Hillsborough, Cornelius, Forest Grove, North Plains. And it took me about 2 minutes to get here. I live very close to where we are. The opportunity to represent this area in the legislature, first elected to the Oregon House in 1998, and two terms in the House. I'm serving my first term in the Oregon Senate. Excited about the opportunities that we have, the challenges that are in front of us. Mr. Chair, I appreciate the commitment of the Senate leadership to take the process kind of to the people, and I appreciate you helping to facilitate this first meeting here in Western Washington County. Really, as we look at business and economic development, I think the story that Western Washington County has to tell about how it has grown and the role that it plays in our state's overall economy and some of the tools that the state has provided local governments, local economic development agencies to use, you'll find that Hillsborough has taken full advantage of those tools. And I am excited to hear from our local government economic development professionals. I'm glad to see our chamber executive director in the audience, Deanna Palm, and we have a very good relationship between the public and private sector here in Western Washington County, and I'm pleased that the committee's here to see a portion of that experience, and perhaps we can learn some additional tools that might be helpful for some of our local governments and local businesses that we may take back to Salem. Take advantage of the opportunity that we're in session and introduce some new statutes and find ways that we can continue to grow and build our state's economy. With that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate, again, this opportunity. I welcome all of you to this hearing, and I'm pleased that we're here today.
Thank you, Senator Starr. And I'm Rick Metzger. I represent East Clackamas County, all of Mount Hood, and Hood River County. and have served in the legislature since election in 1998. Today on our agenda, our first 35 minutes or so, we're going to have a presentation of overview of some economic development issues here in Western Washington County. And then we'll be moving to our agenda, in which we have scheduled three bills for hearing, possible work session after that. And I can see coming through the door Senator Decker from Beaverton is about to join us. So we'll have him say hello as he walks on in. But as we're getting prepared for that, I'd ask Larry Peterson and Don Otterman to please come forward. Welcome.
Thank you, Senators.
Would you like
to All right.
My name is Larry Peterson. I'm the Economic Development Director for the City of Hillsborough, and I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee this morning. I'm going to keep my remarks focused on, as per the handout that the committee received, and which will be put in the record, in terms of the historical context a bit of the economy of Western Washington County, what's going on with the economy now, some issues that are of concern, issues that are opportunities. Hopefully that will enlighten the committee as to things, policy issues that might be a positive impact on the economy. First of all, Hillsborough as a community was the historical trade and government center of the Tualatin Valley, and as much of Oregon, the economy was really grounded in agricultural and forest products up to the 1970s. The high-tech sector evolution really began in the 1980s, and not coincidentally, our mayor was here before the all of this happened. So Mayor Tom Hughes just joined us at the table. But not coincidentally, when the economic boom of the 1980s happened, the population boom also happened, not just in Hillsborough, but really in Washington County generally, and certainly in Western Washington County. While that economic boom of the 90s was a terrific thing, it also was a pinnacle to fall from, I guess, a bit when the economic, the technology swoon of the early 2000s happened. The economy now. Technology companies are rebounding. Intel continues strong and steadfast in their commitment to Hillsborough and to Washington County. Companies like FEI and Sun Microsystems continue to grow and prosper. International companies have refocused their investments. There's a bit of a misconception that international companies have withdrawn from Oregon. The truth is that they've not withdrawn, rather they refocused and refocused their investments in different business lines, and great examples of that are Epson, who is no longer manufactures printers here, but does a great job in terms of ink delivery systems and research and development. So not quite the 1,500 or 1,600 jobs we had 10 years ago, but still a vital contributor to the economy. Something that the committee should be aware of that is, we think, terrific news is that our smaller homegrown companies are showing some real strength. These folks typically operate sort of below the radar, but some companies have done well enough, even through the economic downturn, where they're actually now absorbing some of the surplus assets that maybe larger, more visible companies have left. Noticeable examples of that are Davis Tool, Hanson Architectural Systems, and Cascade Tech, all locally grown Washington County companies that have done and are continuing to do very well. But Hillsborough also, in Western Washington County generally, stays true to its agricultural roots. The nursery business certainly is strong and vital here, as it is in Senator Anderson and Senator Metzger's districts. Continues to be a very important part of our economy. As the economy changed in Western Washington County, so too did the composition of our communities. Certainly when Mayor Hughes was young, shortly after David Hill established the city, Hillsborough and Western Washington County, I would say were predominantly Anglo communities. That's changed a lot, and it's, that change has particularly accelerated over the last two decades. Whereas Hillsborough was a town of 28,000 people in 1980, today we're about 50 citizens short of 80,000. And the composition of the community has changed as well. Hillsborough is over a 30% minority community. The predominance of that are Latino citizens, but also strong representation from various Asian ethnicities. And while that change in size and diversity presents some challenges, certainly it also presents some terrific opportunities. One should point out that also the change in community has been accompanied by some stresses, I guess, on the social support fabric of Washington County, and I'm sure we're Washington County here. They tell you about some certainly budget challenges, but program delivery challenges that they face. So what are the economic strengths? Well, certainly I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that Intel's corporate presence in Washington County continues to be their single largest worldwide, with over 15,000 employees. The State Department of Revenue calculates that more than half of the state's entire high-tech assessed value is located in Hillsborough. Firms that are on the leading edge of nanotechnology, which is something that you all will hear, I think, talked about a lot in session, is nanotechnology or new technologies. There's a lot of that activity here in Hillsborough and Western Washington County with Intel, FEI, TriQuint, and others. Mayor Hughes and I were delighted and to attend the announcement of our neighbor city of Beaverton's beginning of their software incubator, which is really something that's exciting. And within the context not just of high tech but of low tech, the entrepreneurial spirit continues to be very strong. So economic challenges: the technology sector continues to be fragile. You know, it's like one step forward, two steps back every time. It looks like things, company A produces a good, strong performance report, then company B falls at the next day with a substandard one. So, we sort of jiggle back and forth, but never out of the trend line. Regional land use decisions continues to restrict location choices for potential business sightings, and I think Mayor Hughes wants to comment about that. Many new residents face barriers to full participation in the economy, whether they're barriers of language skills or educational attainment. That's clearly an issue. The city of Hillsborough, in summary, continues to work towards the diversification of our economy, both by business recruitment and by supporting entrepreneurial activities and the activities of homegrown businesses. There's a strong collaboration between the city and the Hillsborough Chamber, which is the Hillsborough Economic Development Partnership. They support entrepreneurism for Anglo businesses, Latino businesses, home-based businesses, and we think that that's a model that certainly we're proud of and would be happy to discuss with other communities around the state. Collaboration with education and workforce training entities continue to try and address the education and language gaps. And finally, the city is working within legal frameworks to try and rationalize land use decisions to be more responsive to the marketplace, the business community, and the realities of providing infrastructure services. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome, Mr. Mayor, and thank you for letting us come to your city.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for coming to my city, and I apologize for being late. One of the disadvantages of having you here is that I wind up getting sidetracked on my way from my house to here, and had a constituent who had some problem that I had to take care of, but I'm very happy that you're here, and I want to welcome you to Hillsborough. There's not much to add after Larry gets through usually, but I would call your attention to a couple of things. The success that Hillsborough has had, particularly during the 90s, of recruiting and retaining and expanding businesses, particularly in the high-tech sector within our community, has attracted a lot of attention statewide and nationally. During that period of time, particularly in the 90s, we doubled the population of the city. We expanded our high-tech, added probably 45,000 family wage jobs. Is the map upside?
That over.
Oh.
I think it's upside down.
He majored in economics, not geography.
that looks more like Hillsborough.
And we had a great deal of success. I oftentimes am asked around the state by other communities, to what do I attribute the success? And there's a lot of factors, obviously. The state's decision to change the tax code was vital in terms of recruiting Japanese companies in particular into the United States, and the sort of fortuitous occurrence that we changed our tax code and California refused to change theirs meant that a lot of companies that wanted to come to the West Coast thought that coming to Oregon was a good way to thumb their nose at California, and we recruited them. We did a good job of recruiting them in that way. Some of those companies have subsequently left. They're apparently no longer interested in thumbing their nose at California, but many of them are here and remain fairly robust in our economy. We had availability of water because my predecessors had the foresight to build a water system that was adequate for the needs, way beyond the needs of the community at the time, and continues to be adequate for the needs of a high-tech community. We had land availability. We had good planning. I think, though, that the oftentimes overlooked component to that is that very early in our relationship, particularly with Intel, but with the high-tech community in general, we evolved a way of dealing with high-tech that becomes very important in terms of meeting the needs that the high-tech community has. They have morphed the type of industry that takes place in Hillsborough pretty dramatically since the first Intel plant was built out of Hawthorne Farms. We no longer do very much manufacturing. Most of what happens in Hillsborough now is research and development and developmental manufacturing. And what that has meant for us is that as the nature of this knowledge-based industry in Hillsborough has changed, we have to be agile and flexible in meeting the needs of the industry. It's not uncommon now for a company that we potentially are recruiting to come to us and ask about a parcel of land. If we bring you a set of plans today, can we be operational a year from today? And the community that can't answer that question yes is probably not going to be on anybody's short list for where they want to bring their business. And we've evolved probably as well as any community in the state of Oregon the ability to do that. A year ago, we completed, Intel completed their D1D plant, the largest and most sophisticated fab plant in the world. And we We were required to do about 25,000 inspections on that plant as it got constructed. Our inspection schedule never interfered with the construction schedule, and Intel was able to finish their plant ahead of schedule and under budget. And I think the ability to be able to do that is a key component to our ability, and it's part of the reputation that we've established in the high-tech community. Even in the low-tech community, when Beaverton Foods, for example, had to expand, they looked at two places, Hillsboro and Kansas City, and the requirement was that they had to be operational in a very short period of time when they took their machinery out of their old factory and installed it in their new factory. They were able to do that in Hillsboro probably better than any place else. And the Bee Gees, although they are dyed-in-the-wool Beaverton folks, will tell you that Hillsboro probably can do that better than anybody else. We've evolved a fire department that responds to inspections, a building department, a planning department. Our economic development is second to none anywhere, even though it's relatively small, it's very aggressive. What is now beginning to happen to us is our ability to retain that flexibility is being challenged. And it's not being challenged by the state. I think you'll hear a lot of folks say state land use laws need to be changed because I'm not as critical of state laws because the process is our planners put together the comprehensive plan, we put together our implementing ordinances, we go to the state, we get approval, and once we're approved, then we're good to go. And we can relate then to the needs of the businesses in our community as those come up within the context of pre-approved laws and plans that we have in place. The difficulty right now has been the expansion over the last few years of the authority of the regional government. And part of that I would describe as mission creep. And I don't really blame any of the individuals involved in Metro or Metro itself. I believe strongly in it's important to have effective regional government and effective regional cooperation. But what has begun to happen is that they've begun to go from setting broad policies about where we ought to go to making very specific requirements of what local ordinances and local codes have to say. And in some cases, those specific requirements run directly contrary to our ability to deliver a flexible planning process in dealing with the businesses that want to locate here. We recently were engaged in a case before the Land Use Board of Appeals, which unfortunately didn't go the way we wanted it to go. But LUBA cited a 2-to-1 decision, state statute, not Metro Charter, and I want to be clear about that. They cited state statute as authorizing Metro to have plenary authority over the planning process of every city in the region. What they said essentially is if Metro wants to rewrite Hillsborough's planning code, zoning code, they could do that and impose it on us, and we'd have to accept that. That's not the place that you want people writing zoning code if you want our zoning code to be flexible enough to respond to the needs of the businesses that want to locate here. And so that mission creep into the specifics of zoning, how many square feet can be in a restaurant if you're going to site a restaurant in an industrial area, how many square feet can you have in medical dental, those kinds of specific details really take away the flexibility that we have, and in some cases, quite frankly, violate master planning agreements that we have with businesses that are looking to expand in our region. And so those companies are now beginning to say, I may have to look someplace else where the regulatory environment is more cooperative as a place to go. When we talk to companies that come in, we've had a couple of examples. We had a fairly large pharmaceutical company that came in looking at a parcel of land in Hillsboro, and the state basically sent them to Metro first because Metro's conditions on a piece of land that's within the city of Hillsborough are so specific that it would, for example, prescribe the type of utilities that a company has to use in order to locate on that 200-acre parcel of land. Metro gave them the right answers, but the fact that they had to process through the Metro process at all was enough to discourage them from locating here, and they took us off the long list of folks they were going to screen down to. That type of example is going to happen to us, I think, all too often as we compete with the very limited number of jobs that are going to be moving around within the high-tech industries. If we are allowed to continue to have the type of flexibility that we've always had, that we've always, we can continue to grow this center, our centers of knowledge-based industries, because we have tremendous potential. OHSU has a West Campus with about 500 acres that would be ideal for biotech. We are the heart not only of the silicon industry, but we're also the heart of what is emerging as a nanotech industry. And so we have all of the components here and all of the players here to really come out of this slump in the economy and grow that sector of the economy if we're allowed to retain the flexibility that we need in order to do that. So I think that's my message to you today, and we'll probably be talking to you a little bit more specifically somewhat later on about sections of the law that we think need to be cleaned up. But as a concept, I want to alert you to the fact that this is a potential threat to the economic future of our region that we would hope you could help us clean up. Other than that, I'm happy that you're here. I'm happy that you're able to see some of the facilities that we have available in our community, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mayor. You actually underestimated yourself. You had plenty to add to Mr. Peterson. So. Sir, please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Don Otterman. I'm the city manager for the city of North Plains. We go from the largest city in western Washington County to one of the smallest cities in western Washington County. North Plains has a population of about 1,700 people. We are located just basically north and west of where we are right now by about 3 or 4 miles. The city was formed, or platted actually, in 1911. The city's economic base revolved around agricultural industry and rail service at that time. There was a thriving grocery store, bank, furniture store, and other businesses located along Commercial Street, which is the main street in North Plains in 1911. North Plains had its own rail depot, but the depot was closed and the rail service no longer served North Plains. It goes through North Plains. It does not stop in North Plains. North Plains had a reputation in the early days, basically, of anything goes. If a business wanted to be located in Washington County, but would not be accepted in other communities in the county, it moved to North Plains. An example of that was the Danton Russell creosote plant that was located in North Plains that went bankrupt several years ago and became a federal Superfund site because of the open pits that they used to soak telephone poles in creosote. That Superfund site has been cleaned up. However, the chemical plume that radiated from that Superfund site has now surrounded the water well, and the city is in the process of constructing a 3-mile-long pipeline to get to the Joint Water Commission facilities in Hillsborough to provide the city with drinking water in the future. We've obtained a loan from the state for that project, and consequently our water rates are one of the highest in the state of Oregon. The city incorporated in 1963 with the intent of cleaning up its reputation, but for many years little happened in North Plains. Up until 1990, the city qualified for community development block grant funding because the more than 50% of the population was low and moderate income. Since that time, there has been a change in the population breakdown of the community as far as economics are concerned, and we no longer qualify on a citywide basis for federal funding through community development block grants. So that's another source of funding for economic development that we no longer have. Downtown North Plains was more viable in 1911 than it is today. The city is striving to become a sustainable community by providing services to our residents on the job base so that our residents don't have to go to Hillsboro or Beaverton or Portland for shopping and employment. However, our land costs being close enough in to Hillsboro and the rest of Washington County, our land costs are comparable to the rest of Washington County, but the businesses feel that we are located too far to the west. And so if there's available land in other areas of the county, they will opt to go and or to locate in those areas rather than locating in North Plains. Our city was designated an electronic commerce enterprise zone, and there are, of course, some tax benefits available to businesses to locate in North Plains. But the property owners and the real estate companies that market the property in North Plains are not really knowledgeable of the enterprise zone system, and all the marketing that takes place of North Plains properties does not include any mention of the enterprise zone designation. The city has no staff time to be able to devote to economic development because we have a lack of funding, because we don't have the tax base, because we don't have the commercial and industrial uses. So it's basically a catch-22. The city no longer qualifies, as I stated before, we no longer qualify for block grant funding on a citywide basis to make improvements, economic improvements in the community. One answer that the city has identified to assist our efforts is the expansion of the urban growth boundary for residential construction, and to allow the construction of residences to increase our population. Located in North Plains that went bankrupt several years ago and became a federal Superfund site because of the open pits that they used to soak telephone poles in creosote. That Superfund site has been cleaned up. However, the chemical plume that radiated from that Superfund site has now surrounded the water well, and the city is in the process of constructing a three-mile-long pipeline to get to the Joint Water Commission facilities in Hillsboro to provide the city with drinking water in the future. We've obtained a loan from the state for that project, and consequently our water rates are one of the highest in the state of Oregon. The city incorporated in 1963 with the intent of cleaning up its reputation, but for many years little happened in North Plains. Up until 1990, the city qualified for community development block grant funding because the more than 50% of the population was low and moderate income. Since that time, there has been a change in the population breakdown of the community as far as economics are concerned, and we no longer qualify on a citywide basis for federal funding through community development block grants. So that's another source of funding for economic development that we no longer have. Downtown North Plains was more viable in 1911 than it is today. The city is striving to become a sustainable community by providing services to our residents on the job base so that our residents don't have to go to Hillsboro, Beaverton, or Portland for shopping and employment. However, our land costs being close enough in to Hillsborough and the rest of Washington County, our land costs are comparable to the rest of Washington County, but the businesses feel that we are located too far to the west. And so if there's available land in other areas of the county, they will opt to go and, or to locate in those areas rather than locating in North Plains. Our city was designated an electronic commerce enterprise zone, and there are, of course, some tax benefits available to businesses to locate in North Plains. But the property owners and the real estate companies that market the property in North Plains are not really knowledgeable of the enterprise zone system, and all the marketing that takes place in North Plains properties does not include any mention of the enterprise zone designation. The city has no staff time to be able to devote to economic development because we have a lack of funding, because we don't have the tax base, because we don't have the commercial and industrial uses. So it's basically a catch-22. The city no longer qualifies, as I stated before, we no longer qualify for block grant funding on a citywide basis to make improvements, economic improvements in the community. One answer that the city has identified to assist our efforts is the expansion of the urban growth boundary for residential construction, and to allow the construction of residences to increase our population, which will then hopefully increase the appeal of the community to new commercial uses. However, we've been involved in our urban growth boundary expansion for 10 years. That is how long it has taken us to go through the state process, and we are still in appeals. We have an expansion of our urban growth boundary that has been approved finally by LCDC that would expand 144 acres to the community. There is another work task involved in our periodic review work program that is under appeal to LUBA, and so we are waiting for the outcome of that appeal to determine whether or not we are going to be able to then put on the ballot for an annexation question of whether or not the land should be annexed into the city of North Plains. We are looking to create an urban renewal project area in the city of North Plains, in the downtown area, to be able to improve our downtown. However, consultant time to prepare that the staff work necessary to create an urban renewal project area is expensive enough that the city doesn't have the funds to hire the consultant to do the work. So again, it's a catch-22. We want to improve our downtown area. We don't have the funds to be able to do the work necessary to create the urban renewal project area to be able to start improving downtown. We had a plan that was approved by the city for the revitalization of our downtown area. It was funded by a loan from the state, as well as matching funds from the city of North Plains. We have plans for the infrastructure of our downtown area completed to about 85% of the total of working drawings completion, but no funds to take the next step to actually make those improvements a reality. So Hillsborough, on the one hand, has all of the economic development engines in high gear. The city of North Plains is trying to do that, and every way we turn, we somehow get stymied and cannot take the next step. So we definitely would love to have some assistance from the state. At this point, I don't have any specific bills that I could say, let's introduce this bill to try to help us out of this situation. I think we'll be working probably with our Senator Bruce Starr, who's been extremely supportive of the city of North Plains in our efforts. We do have another problem or another issue going on right now, and that's the Department of Land Conservation and Development is proposing to amend Goal 14, which it has to do with expansion of urban growth boundary, and they are making some changes that would basically undo the LCDC decision to allow North Plains to expand its urban growth boundary. And so we are in an effort to try to counter that and to not basically have to maybe go back to square one on our urban growth boundary expansion decision. So we're a small city. We you know, 1,700 people. We have a staff of 12 people. We have three police officer positions, one funded by a levy. Levy expires in July. We went to the voters in November just to keep that one police officer position, and that was turned down, so we're looking at possibly laying off a police officer and going to basically 80 hours a week of police services. So, you know, the economy has really hit North Plains pretty hard, and like I said, we're in a catch-22. Every time we try to do something, something else gets in our way. And the lack of, you know, basically it takes money to make money for the most part. We don't have the money to start out with, and so we continue to strive, continue to work. Hopefully we will be successful in our efforts, but at this point in time, it's very frustrating. And we hope that the economy turning around in the state of Oregon will be an assistance to the city of North Plains. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Otterman. Questions of any of the panelists from the committee? Yeah.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd like to ask the man from North Plains, what is the land that you would like to incorporate into your city being used as now?
It's basically some of it's higher level farmland, some of it's lower level farmland. There's about 144 acres. A little over 70 acres is class 4 soil, and has quite a large wetland area on the property. And the other area is AF20 zoning, but is used for S farmland.
All right. So is the reason the urban growth boundary hasn't happened for you is due to the fact that it's farmland, wetland, for environmental reasons?
It's, well, there were a couple things. One is that there is property directly to the south of North Plains, south of Highway 26, that is exception land, which means that it's zoned other than for farm use. Some of it is actually in farm use and actually higher productivity of farm use than the other areas that we are trying to get inside the UGB. Some of it is used for other than farming use. The property owner of that property had a development agreement or an option with a developer to develop his property. And they were arguing that exception land had to be taken inside of an urban growth boundary before resource land. And we basically were tied up for probably 4 years in arguments, legal arguments, and arguments, quite frankly, in the state legislature about that issue. And though that developer is no longer in the picture, Land Conservation and Development Commission did rule in our favor that the city needed to look at exception land, but that if our needs were other than to include exception land into our urban growth boundary, that we had made the adequate findings to do that. There is another work task that is involved in our periodic review, which is basically we had to make our comprehensive plan consistent with the counties as far as the actual urban growth boundary designations. That has now been appealed to the Land Use Board of Appeals by the property owner on the south side of Highway 26, still carrying on the fight to try to get his land inside of the urban growth boundary. And so that's where we are in that process. And like I say, now LCDC is looking at changing Goal 14, which if we were to be remanded back to LCDC and those changes were made in Goal 14, we'd have to basically go back to square one. And going across what eventually someday will be an eight-lane freeway, and dividing your residential area in half by an eight-lane freeway does not make land use sense. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Okay, what we're going to do now, because we have reached the time frame for this part, and we have Chief Louie and others who have promised time specific to be able to testify, we're going to close the informational hearing on economic development issues in Washington County. When we go through the agenda, if other people want to comment on that, we will return to that. So with that, I'm going to close that part of our agenda and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 367 and ask Ms. Van Winkle to explain Senate Bill 367 to us.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 367 requires drivers and passengers in privately owned commercial vehicles designed and used to transport 15 or fewer persons, such as shuttle vans and small buses, to use safety belts. The bill also exempts such vehicles from requiring child safety seats.
Okay, thank you very much. I think what we'll do, looking at our time frame, I'm going to ask Chief Ron Louie from the Hillsborough Police Department to come forward. Thank you for taking the time to come. I know you have an appointment afterwards, so.
Thank you, Senator. Chief Ron Louie, Hillsborough Police Department. I do appreciate the opportunity for not having to drive I-5 to Salem, so thank you very much. The purpose of my being here today is just to very briefly explain the position, public safety position on seatbelts. I recognize that this is dealing specifically with those private vehicles that we'd call cabs, transportation. In a nutshell, in my 31 years in police, I've always had to deal with this issue of seatbelt usage. In the 70s, police officers were not required to wear seatbelts. So I was engaged in that argument of why not require officers. Finally, our injury rate became so high that we had to require his policy to wear seatbelts. Fast forward to 1987 when I became the Chief of Police of Astoria. City of Astoria and the City of Pendleton had the distinction of having the lowest seatbelt usage in the state of Oregon. The good news is ODOT gave us a lot of money to try and educate. And what we were able to do is focus on education and seatbelt usage and kind of break the habit and change the habit. The bill being proposed and the addition is good public policy. And I have heard arguments on the other side. I'm not trying to put them out as straw arguments, but the police officers would always be worried about being strapped in, that they couldn't get out of a flaming vehicle as they were rolling over or whatever. We would train our officers not to drive that way anyway, so they won't be in that position, number one. Number two, it really boils down to physics. We can't change the law of physics when a moving body has to come to a sudden stop. Simple as that. What we can do is mitigate that with the use of belts and seat belts. With cabs, I travel, many of you travel a lot, you go to areas where it is required that when you get into transportation, privately owned transportation vehicle, 15 or less, very common going from an airport, whether it be Hong Kong or Bangkok, you have to put on a seatbelt. The reason is because, and the Bangkok police and the Hong Kong police say the same thing, too many people get injured when we don't require it. So my position for good public policy is we should require passengers and drivers to be belted because it's safe and it's good public policy.
Thank you, Chief Louie. Questions from the Chief? Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that the position of the Chiefs of Police Association, or are you stating?
That's my position, not of the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police. That's my position as a police chief, also one that over the years that have engaged in public education on seatbelt usage and has been a target of improving usage primarily in Astoria, but thankfully not in Hillsborough. But we in the state specifically provides additional funding for police officers to enforce the seatbelt rule. So it's, again, it's my experience over the years, and we have 1,900 crashes in Hillsborough alone. By the way, that's less than we had in 2003. But overall, the things that we can do to reduce injuries to people in vehicles. Seatbelt is the number one thing we can do. After that, it gets to good driving habits, bald tires when it rains, those kinds of things. But number one, seatbelt usage. And that's why we're very strict in the city, as we are in pedestrian enforcement. And those seem to work.
Question? Thank you, Chief. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you very much.
Before we go to our next witnesses, just for the audience, Senate Bill 367 came about primarily because of the tragedy that we witnessed in Portland a few weeks ago when the mother of a figure skater here for the U.S. Skating Championship died, was not strapped in, and it was evaluated that may have survived had they been strapped in. I think that shocked a lot of the public, certainly those of us in the legislature, to understand that there was in fact an exemption for passenger vehicles. I was certainly unaware of it. Most people we talked to were unaware of it. And doing a little research how that happened, when the seatbelt law was placed into law some 15 years ago, there was concern by a number of folks, particularly delivery drivers like UPS drivers that were like getting in and out and wanted to be exempted. And so the exemption was put in as a commercial class. So it wasn't like they said taxi cab, they said a commercial class, and the way it was defined in law, it covered all of those folks who were actually transporting persons. And I think that's one of those unintended consequences that you put in, and then until something bad happens, you don't realize that that was not appropriate. And certainly also today, we've been having seatbelts for a long time, and now we have other passenger restraint systems which are designed to be effective only with the use of seatbelts. So this is an evolution in why we're here having this discussion today. Next, I'd like to ask Justin Dune and Marion Gaylord from the City of Portland Licensing Bureau to please come forward.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Chairman Metzger and members of the committee, I very much appreciate an opportunity to address you in this area. I am Marion Gaylord, the Supervisor of Regulatory Programs in the Bureau of Licenses for the City of Portland. We're located at 111 Southwest Columbia, room 600, Portland 97201. City of Portland strongly supports Senate Bill 367 and its requirement that seatbelts be used by drivers and passengers of private for hire transportation. The city's regulatory program, which oversees private for hire transportation in the Portland area, is committed to improving safety for drivers and their passengers. And we believe that the use of seatbelts is a practical and very easily implemented way to mitigate traffic injuries and deaths. As Chairman Metzger mentioned, on January 13th of this year, a taxi van carrying a U.S. figure skating contestant and her parents was involved in an accident that resulted in a fatality and one hospitalization. Unfortunately, no one in the vehicle was wearing seatbelts, and Portland police have expressed the belief that seatbelts might have prevented the fatality and the seriousness of the injuries. We support this legislation for one simple reason. Seatbelts are proven to save lives and reduce serious injuries. Private for hire drivers typically log between 3 and 5 times as many miles as the typical Oregon driver under the highest risk conditions of late night, adverse weather, dimly lit streets. Their need for seatbelts is actually greater, not less, than ordinary drivers. While some drivers may contend that if they're required to wear seatbelts, it may put them at risk to injury from a violent passenger, we would argue that the chance of a driver being injured or killed by a passenger is far, far less than that of being injured or killed in an auto accident because they're failing to wear a seatbelt. Passengers of town cars, shuttles, and taxi cabs are traveling the same streets in the same conditions as other Oregon citizens and visitors and deserve the same degree of safety and protection. The fact that a passenger vehicle is used for hire transportation affords it no special protection from traffic accidents. Finally, our only objection to this bill is its the portion of the proposed legislation which exempts for-hire vehicles from the state requirements for safety seats that protect infants and children. It's a well-documented fact that infants and children are at much greater risk in auto accidents than are adults for a number of reasons. While it's true that many sedan-sized taxis and town cars don't have room to carry all the various sizes of the child seats, the majority of for-hire transportation is arranged in advance and is dispatched. And under these circumstances, a very small proportion of these rides are actually hailed on the street. So as a result, with a dispatched call, it would not be that difficult for them to provide a child safety seat. There would be time to arrange for that. We suggest that at least as an interim measure that this bill be modified to allow local jurisdictions to develop appropriate guidelines for the use of child safety systems. Unfortunately, we are concerned that the legislation as it is proposed now may be used to justify a practice of not allowing parents to use the vehicle seat belts to secure their own child safety seats out of what I think is a misguided fear for the driver's personal liability. And in conclusion, the City of Portland strongly supports this bill with the recommendation that it be modified to require appropriate child safety systems or to allow local jurisdictions to develop appropriate standards. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Newton.
Marion's covered the basis thoroughly. The only thing I would add is to point out, while we think of this bill in terms of taxis, there are, in fact, almost as many non-taxi for-hire vehicles that would be affected. Those include shuttle vehicles, and they also include non-emergency medical vehicles, as well as town cars. And the risk of attack by a passenger on a driver in those vehicles makes a comparison in safety between seatbelts and non-seatbelts even more of a contrast. Seatbelts save lives, and there's a lot of vehicles out there, a lot of passengers that would be affected.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? I would comment one of the, and get your feedback. I'm interested in your suggestion about the local jurisdiction adopting rules. The reason this was put in the language in the first place was that, of course, currently they don't have to have the child restraint seats because they don't have to have seat belts, so it's actually not a new exemption. But it was a recognition of the fact that, especially in the taxi cabs, if they all had to have child seats in them, that might pose a difficulty. And I'm thinking more importantly from and have the appropriate seats. Those would be at the airport, who are there randomly. They're not prearranged. They're just passengers coming in and coming out and making sure that there was not an unusual restraint on business. Hoping that that is certainly, though, that they were available, they would be used by an individual company or not. But I'm interested in your approach. I think that that has merit. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Okay, let's ask Steve, is it Antler? Oh, yeah. Radio cab to come forward, please. Welcome, thanks for coming.
Good morning. Steve Antler, I'm the general manager for Radio Cab Company. Radio Cab Company is a driver-owned company, probably the oldest, if not the largest one in the state of Oregon. And I'm here to speak on behalf of my bosses, which are the drivers. Approximately 2 years ago, and as a result of an immediate reaction to the shooting death of a taxi driver, the city of Portland set out on a mission to reduce the likelihood of any more of these sort of tragedies, throughout Portland. It was decided eventually that GPS location devices, in-vehicle surveillance and security cameras, and standardized personal safety training for all of the cab drivers would be very helpful in making a very dangerous job a little safer. although these programs have not yet been fully implemented, they are at least in progress at this time. The standardized personal safety training curriculum has not been finalized at this point, but will likely conflict with the proposed mandatory seatbelt use ordinance. I fully support the mandatory seatbelt use requirement, but I would suggest that modification should be made in the interest of driver safety. Seatbelt use should be mandatory for passengers, but optional for the drivers. In conversations with drivers, I have concluded that most drivers feel that certain passengers present a far greater hazard to their well-being than any potential traffic accident. In certain situations, the drivers sometimes need to quickly vacate the taxi cab or move across the seat or make any number of self-defense moves to prevent injury to themselves during an altercation with a passenger. Mandatory seat belt use for the driver would make these maneuvers very difficult, to say the least. It would also make the driver look somewhat more vulnerable to the would-be assailant. Before any decisions or final decisions are made, I urge you to listen carefully to the drivers, especially the experienced ones. The easy and somewhat obvious requirement for mandatory seatbelt use may end up with some unintended results. As a company, have always suggested to the passengers that they use seatbelts. But when you get to the driver issue, it becomes a little bit more complicated. I can't even think of any fatalities that passenger and or driver fatalities that would be a result of the non-use of seatbelts throughout our 59-year history. And I don't know that a knee-jerk reaction to a recent tragedy is something you should just totally react on without putting some thought into the whole picture. And if I can ask any questions about the operation of a cab company, feel free to ask. I'm maybe the only one here today.
226-1212, great.
Get the number right.
Might get Joe's pizza, right? Pizza in the cab. Well, thank you for your testimony. You talked about the company policy. Do you post in the cabs at all, like in the back seat, we recommend you wear your seatbelt? Is there any signage at all?
There is not at this time. Actually, we had just discussed this at a recent board meeting before the proposal came up. Quite frankly, we're overburdened with decals in the passenger area of the cabs, and it's getting to the point where it's almost a visibility problem looking out from the cabs. But we very likely will have some kind of a recommendation for the passengers anyway.
Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Questions for the committee? Senator Stoner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I would have is, do we have any history? I mean, do we have history of accidents? Maybe this company, but I don't know if there's an industry association that keeps those records. I don't know. I'm looking at Troy from ODOT. If there's some records about history of accidents, I'd be curious to know. Is this a problem that the legislature is dealing with this issue because of a recent case, or is there a historical pattern, or are cabs, in my estimation, they would be safer than maybe some of the public drivers, in that these drivers are professionally trained and I would expect to be more conscientious drivers. Because their livelihood depends on that. But could you comment on maybe the historical perspective of accidents and cabs and injuries and deaths as far as from your experience?
Yeah, well, we have a kind of an inside advantage in that typically the average cab was larger than the average car out there. So, you've got that law of physics to help you along. The drivers themselves, even before they were hired, they have to have a very clean driving record, and of course, the survival at the company depends a lot on their driving skills and what happens subsequently to them. We have
Get the number right.
Yeah, get the number right. Might get Joe's pizza, right? Pizza in the cab. Well, thank you for your testimony. You talked about the company policy. Do you post in the cabs at all, like in the back seat? You know, we recommend you wear your seatbelt. Is there any signage at all?
There is not at this time. Actually, we had just discussed this at a recent board meeting before the proposal came up. Quite frankly, we're getting overburdened with decals in the passenger area of the cabs, and it's getting to the point where it's almost a visibility problem looking out, you know, from the cabs. But we very likely will have some kind of a recommendation for the passengers anyway.
Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Questions for the committee? Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I would have is, do we have any history? I mean, do we have history of accidents, maybe the company, but I don't know if there's an industry association that keeps those records. I don't know. I'm looking at Troy from ODOT if there's some records about history of accidents. I'd be curious to know, is this a problem that the legislature is dealing with this issue because of a recent case, or is there a historical pattern, or are cabs, in my estimation, they would be safer than maybe some of the public drivers, in that these drivers are professionally trained and I would expect to be more conscientious drivers. Consider likelihood depends on that. But could you comment on maybe the historical perspective of accidents and cabs and injuries and deaths as far as from your experience?
Yeah, well, we have a kind of an inside advantage in that typically the average cab is larger than the average car out there. So, you've got that law of physics to help you along. The drivers themselves, even before they were hired, they have to have a very clean driving record, and of course their survival at the company depends a lot on their driving skills and what happens subsequently to them. We have the only records we really have basically loss runs over are kept annually and for quite a period of time by the insurance companies that we have to deal with. Cabs typically log on quite a few miles throughout the year. The average mileage put on the average cab, at least within our company, is close to 100,000 a year. They're operated 24/7. Under all kinds of circumstances and throughout all kinds of unfamiliar territory. So the exposure to accidents is far greater than you would experience typically in a private car, where typically you're going, in areas that you're familiar with and on regular time schedules.
Senator Ross Harrison and Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Antler?
Yes.
Yes. How many altercations, do you have any data as to how many altercations actually occur between passenger and driver?
It's not one that we typically keep records of. Radio cab probably does more night business, and that's where you're going to have the biggest problems. We do more night business with all the clubs, bars, taverns, restaurants, you name it, than probably any other company around. And that's where you're going to typically have the most problems. And I will say that over the years, a lot of those, the frequency of those type of incidents has come down greatly from what it used to be many years ago. We have female drivers now driving at night that would never have happened 20 years ago. I mean, and they have little, if any, problems. But they still, the drivers themselves always want to have some means of protecting themselves. And it's one of the things that we're supposed to be discussing in these standardized safety training issues. Like I pointed out, it may conflict with driver common sense. I suspect that you probably received some phone calls or some emails from some of the drivers that could not or chose not to show up here today. This is a Friday and one of their bigger days for making money. But I would just kind of urge you to listen carefully before you make any off-the-ball decisions that may affect their personal safety.
One follow-up.
Yes,
also, some passengers just are too big for the seatbelts that are, for most of us, that we can wear. Extenders, do you carry extenders in the cabs?
No, I'm not aware of them being that large. I guess there probably is certain cases that I haven't heard of any.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Antler, thank you. I know it's sometimes difficult when you hear government is, and we're here to help in your industry, but your presence is definitely helpful. The question I have is around the infant. I was just in a cab in Mexico, and I can tell you, first of all, the driving skills of Portland taxi drivers and those of the ones that are in Mexico are appreciably higher here.
Wow, what a recommendation.
Did you use it in a pamphlet or do you need a marketing endorsement? What is the behavior that you find for folks who have infants with them? The recommendation was made from the City of Portland that we should require it, which seems, I'm skeptical of that we would require taxis and van companies to have seats. But what is your experience then with parents who have infants at the airport or at a restaurant? I would think it's more at the airport. Do they bring typically, and are there ones that don't bring car seats? And then are there drivers that would deny them the ride? It seems to me if a driver denied, you could always easily find a driver that would accept. That's been our experience.
I don't know that anybody would deny that. Speaking as a parent, at least, most of the time we came prepared with our own child seat, if that was the calling. I know they come in all different sizes nowadays, depending on the size of the child. It would be very restrictive for any cab to carry those kind of devices around. We do for some contractual arrangements with like Portland Public Schools and some of the other school districts where they require, they even supply them in a lot of cases, and we do carry them for those. I know that Justin Dunn said that it would be very easy for us to, if these advance reservations were made for the driver to pick it up. That may or may not be the case. It's a little bit hard for me to picture a driver making a special trip down to the building just to pick up a child seat to take it out to pick up that child. It could be done. It would be difficult. It would be inconvenient, but it could be done. But I don't recall anybody ever requesting it either. So,
Mr. Chair, maybe a better way of asking that question. How common is it that you find parents who have an infant with them or a child and have no car seat with them? And percentages are difficult to...
I don't have enough knowledge to answer that question, but it does happen, I will tell you that. Yes.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very, very much. And members, I want to thank Ms. Van Winkle too, because we worked very hard to contact the cab people because they didn't have an organized system and we wanted them here early in the process, not later in the process, so this really helps us work on this issue. Kathy, yes?
If I may, before we call the next witness, I'd like to recognize and honor the Mayor Forrest Grove, who's joined us, Mayor Richard Kidd.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you, Representative. Mm-hmm. Kathy Bowles, please.
Hello.
Good morning.
Chairman Scarrow and members of the committee, my name is Kathy Bowles. I live in Lake Oswego. And I wanted to tell you about my experience last week while riding in an airport shuttle van, which is the reason that I'm here, because I didn't actually realize we were going to have a proposed seatbelt bill. I got into the cabin, and first let me tell you that I work for Trauma Nurses Talk Tough, which is a legacy manual hospital program, and I do seatbelt and traffic injury prevention education. So I have a lot of information about this issue. But anyway, I got into an airport van last week, and during the course of the drive to the airport, I was questioning the van driver a little bit about his opinion about what had happened in the fatal crash that had occurred the week previous. And he had a lot of opinions about that, one of which is that he thought that the driver had been cited for other reasons, other traffic reasons. And I had noticed that he wasn't wearing his safety belt, this driver, and I asked him if he'd ever been cited for not wearing his safety belt, and he said no, because it wasn't a requirement for him, but that he always wore a safety belt in private cars that he drove for himself, and that his wife and daughter were very insistent that he wear it, but he didn't think it was a problem in the van. And I said, well, did you know in a crash that your body could become the flying object that could take your passengers out? And he said, well, he wasn't really concerned about that or his passengers' safety for that matter. And so then I said, well, gosh, you sound like a pretty great father, because he was talking about his daughter quite a bit. And I said, you know, what would your family do if you were killed in a crash simply because you weren't wearing a seatbelt? And he says, oh, you're good at this, aren't you? And I said, well, it was just a question I thought I'd pose, you know. And so a little bit later, he said, you know, seatbelts are really inconvenient for what I do. And I said, well, let me tell you how inconvenient a wheelchair or a brain injury can be. And at that point, my husband leapt into this conversation and said, you know, my wife teaches this education, and so it's pretty near and dear to her heart. And I said, I'll tell you what, I said, how about just when you transport me, would you be willing to wear your safety belt? And he said, oh, well, we're going to have to cross you off our customer list. And I was stunned. I just really was stunned. I said, well, okay. And got out of the cab or the van at the airport. And my husband said, I don't know how you do this. We had transportation. And now we don't have transportation. And I said, well, I'm thinking he's serious. He said, well, maybe he wasn't serious. So he said, so he called him and he said, well, you're really serious about not transporting us anymore? And the guy said, yeah, really, I'm serious. And then he said, well, do you think that we could ask for another driver from your company and we could ask them if they could wear their safety belt? And he said, well, none of our drivers are required to wear safety belts, and I doubt that they will. And besides which, the next thing will be that your wife is going to want us to tack down the luggage in the van. And I would like to point out to you that I think that's a really good idea, too. And I think it's a really good idea to have children in car seats, because adult bodies flying around who are not secured, drivers or otherwise, are going to take those children out. And they can be taken out even when they're not in car seats, because adult lap belts won't fit them. So, and I will also point out that most parents do carry their own car seats when they're going to fly. So I want to thank you very much for this opportunity to testify. And if you have any questions, happy to answer them.
Thank you, Ms. Bowles. Questions, Senator Starr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony today.
Yeah.
And so you're one of the folks that do the Trauma Nurses Talk Tough program.
I teach young driver programs generally.
Yeah. Well, I'm a former student of that Trauma Nurses Talk Tough program when I was much younger than I am now, and somewhere here, and was
much wiser now. So much wiser now.
Exactly. But the reality is that's a great program, and not only is it important for folks like myself that didn't think a lot about putting on seatbelts before, think a lot about it now, but also as I've gotten older and have kids, the responsibility to make sure they're in the right kind of seat and how much when they're in their bikes and all that. The question I have is child safety seats in taxi cabs. As a responsible parent, shouldn't it be the parent's responsibility that if they're going to carry their child or transport their child on a trip or wherever, shouldn't it be the parent's responsibility to make sure that they're the ones that supply the child safety seat, the one that's an appropriate size for their child?
For the child only.
As opposed to requiring the cab company to go through all of the hassle, really. It's a significant hassle to have to plan ahead and you know, coordinate all of the, you have to coordinate, is the child an infant? You know, is it a child that's 40 pounds and 40 inches taller for all of that? What if we basically told parents that when you're traveling in any vehicle, whether it's one you're driving and you're responsible for or one that you've hired, that you're responsible for ensuring that your child's in an appropriate child safety seat?
Well, it was my understanding that parents are responsible for having their children in car seats these days, and we have a booster seat law as well, and you're not supposed to be traveling around without kids, you know, 60 pounds, but actually pediatric surgeons say it should be 8 and 80 pounds to be absolutely safe. I think that parents generally do, but the problem is that we have some parents that don't. And in that case, I don't know where you get into murky waters there. Are we going to make them rent one? Are we going to make them lease one? Or can they call the Child Safety Seat Center that we have all over the state and be able to borrow one? Perhaps that's something to think about. I don't know how you write that into a bill, maybe promote it properly.
Yeah, I appreciate your testimony. I appreciate the work that you do. And I think that we're going to hear from ODOT's transportation safety official, and we'll ask maybe some of these more detailed questions.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any other questions? Thank you very, very much. Okay, speaking of which, now betting. Troy Costales from ODOT and Tamara Franks, why don't you both come up? Same time. You to go ahead and start, please.
Sure thing. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Riley. Pleasure to be in Hillsborough this morning. As I was explaining to Chairman, this is my fifth bill this week I get a chance to be involved with. So, my name is Troy Costales. I am the manager of the safety division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. And to answer a couple of the questions through the testimony, there's three pieces of my testimony handout that I'll refer to potentially answer some of your questions. First and foremost, it would be good to know that in Oregon, voters put in the safety belt law in 1990. We are the only state in the United States where the citizens voted in the law. When that law was originally put in place, there were some exemptions. And since 1990, through legislative action, there have been exemptions added and some taken away. With all of that, Oregon currently has a 93% safety belt use rate, which is the fourth highest in the country. Senate Bill 367 will narrow the list of exemptions by now requiring safety belts in the vehicles that you've been discussing. And there are multiple states that have a very similar exception to their safety belt law, typically though at a 10 passenger limit, that anybody that's carrying 10 passengers or more are exempt from the safety belt law. On the same vein though, there are multiple states that require all of those vehicles to also use safety belts. So it's a mixed bag across the United States when it comes to vehicles that are for hire for transporting people. Safety belts do make a difference, as you have heard. Generally, in a lap belt situation, the lap belt provides about 50% effectiveness of reducing death or injury in a crash. If you are in a lap and shoulder belt situation, that's about 65% effective in reducing death or injury in a crash. And a lap shoulder and an airbag, you start to approach the 70-75% effectiveness in reducing death or injury. Infant seats and car seats are in that high percentage as well, the 75 or so percentage, where it reduces death or injury in a crash because of protection of the car seat. Since Oregon's law was voted in 1990, our usage rate has gone from below 50% to that 93%, and our death rates and our injury rates in the state have dropped between 35 and 50% in that same amount of time. Our safety belts do work, that make a difference, and I can tell you from personal experience, I've been in other states and other situations where in the cab it's a requirement. Getting into the cab, you have to wear your belt. I can also tell you from personal experience when I've been in a cab and asked about the belts and the driver dismissed it, I got out of the cab and got into the next one when the driver would put on their belt, and I put mine on the back seat as well because it was available to me and made that personal choice in a place where it wasn't required. Attached or part of the packet that I gave to you, there's the research note item, and there's a lot of information in there, but what I would like to call to your attention is about the second or third page. What this report has done for you, and I thought would be the most useful, is it lists all the states and territories of the United States, and on the far right-hand side, it lists what some of the exemptions are in those states. And as you walk through here, you will not find any two that are the same. Everybody is slightly different. There's not a normal way. And what's rather interesting is you look at the fines and what seating positions are covered in the vehicles. They also vary from one end to the other. And Oregon is listed on there so you can get an idea of how we fit. And the other piece of data that it provided to you that Senator Starr had asked about was what are the crash records. And in anticipation of this hearing, we asked the crash data unit to go back as far as they could in looking at situations where there was indicated the vehicle involved in the crash was a taxi or was for hire, and looked at the individuals as far as whether they were not wearing belts, they were wearing belts, or it was unknown, and what level of injury. And when you look at from 1985 forward, there's only one occasion, you know, from 1985 forward where the crash record and the information came forward where there's actually a death involved in this prior to this year. And it's a little hard to see, but on each year when they tell you the injury, injury A is typically a long stay hospital occurrence. Injury B is typically where they will go to the hospital for treatment. They may or may not stay over one night, but it requires typically an ambulance type trip. Injury C is usually treated on the scene. They're not having to take a hospital trip. So I didn't have the chance to go through and rewrite before I even explained what those codes are. It's also interesting to look at this data when you get to 1990, when the safety belt law went into effect. The number shifted from the not belted side to the belted side. So there are some people with individual choices or some companies under their own policies that are very likely asking their passengers to wear belts because otherwise the data wouldn't have shifted like this.
Mr. Chair.
In the monitor.
I find it interesting, thank you. I find it interesting that in this information that you gave us that our penalty, our fines for those who are caught without wearing safety belts is $94. And it's the highest of any state except in Texas. It's between $25 and $200. But most of them are right around $10 to $25 if you're caught. And so I think that's a real incentive for people to want to wear their seatbelt.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moss Anderson, you're correct. Washington is at 101, so they are slightly above where Oregon is. And the 94 in Oregon is actually the lowest class of traffic flying that you can receive. And in other states, they do call out the safety belt fine as a specific item and don't actually tie it to a traffic offense in some states. And on that vein, if I could, Mr. Chair, one last item you're asking about children. The way a safety belt citation works, if you are 16 or older, you receive the safety belt ticket yourself personally, no matter where you are in the car. If the individual is 15 or younger, the citation goes to the driver. So as part of the discussion, you're talking about parents' responsibility and things in a different vehicle when they're not the driver. You have an interesting twist you're going to have to figure out of how to, if you're thinking down those lines, of how you would make that work given that the driver is the one that would get the ticket if it's 15 or younger. And with that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to try and answer any of the other questions you might have in writing down for me.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Costales. I do have just an observation looking at your list. In the exemptions, I was just looking at the neighboring states. I see there's no exemptions in California, and passenger vehicles 10 or more in Washington, and in our other neighboring state, Idaho, just school buses in Vail and Newspaper. So I would read into that, then the taxi cabs do all have to buckle up in all our neighboring states. Did I read that correctly?
Mr. Chair, in Idaho, the safety belt law is a secondary offense, and so the issue there would be they have to commit another traffic violation before being cited for safety belts. And so I can't for certain say that the taxis and limos and shuttle buses are in or out, because if you look at Oregon, it doesn't list that in ours either. It was just, for some reason, they're just highlighting a certain set.
Well, just knowing it's California, just said exemptions, none.
Yeah, and I can't answer that specifically and with 100% assurance without going back and double-checking the details of the law, because sometimes it's buried in a phrase. Because all I can report is what's in here at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Costales. Thank you. Proceed.
Chair Metzger and members of the committee, thank you for your time and attention to this matter today. My name is Tamara Franks, here of Hillsboro, Oregon. And I'm here today as a certified child passenger safety technician instructor, representing the Child Safety Seat Resource Center, and also a mother of two children of booster seat age. So this issue is near and dear to my heart, and I teach it very often. I strongly support the Senate Bill 367, but I also encourage you to include all passengers of all ages in this bill. I think it is pertinent for us to send a consistent message across the state to include the safe transportation of our children, especially from ages 0 to 6 years of age. Motor vehicle crashes continue to be the primary cause of injury and death to children ages 0 to 14. Let's protect our children across the board and not just over the age of 6 in commercially owned vehicles. To facilitate this process, I do strongly recommend that parents or caregivers are responsible for providing the appropriate child restraint system. By child restraint system, I mean a device that is approved for that child of that age that meets the Oregon law, that also meets best practice for that child. This would be similar to the parents or caregivers transporting them in their own private or friends' vehicles. It would also help to reduce from the commercial providers, help to reduce their liability. It's very difficult to provide some type of rental or loaner program for child restraint systems. It's difficult to track the history. Even a small crash can compromise the integrity of a child restraint system. There may not be any visible marks on the child restraints, and so we will not know if the children or if the restraint has been in a crash or not, and it needs to be reported and removed from the system if this does happen, and often that will not occur. I can probably state fairly certainly that would not occur when you're transporting a large number of passengers. Additionally, I think that by including passengers of all ages in the Senate bill, we would encourage the commercial companies, transportation companies, to provide adequate seating positions for all passengers and adequate and fully functioning lap shoulder belts for our passengers so the parents or caregivers can properly install their child restraint systems. Again, I encourage you to send a consistent message and include the children from ages 0 to 6. I am happy to answer any questions on this. And just to follow up on something that was talked about earlier, on the transportation, the National Transportation Safety Board has urged the FAA to ban the lap children, children being held under the age of 2. They have put it on the 10 most wanted safety improvements, and they are encouraging the FAA to require parents to purchase seats on airplanes for their children. What does this mean? It means that parents and families will be traveling with child restraint systems for their children at that age, and they will have them when they arrive in Oregon at their destination point. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Franks. Questions? Thank you very much. Okay, the last two signed up, I'm going to ask Jeanette Thieberg and Elliot Ecke, who I see has come in. If you would come up, the two of you, I would appreciate it very much. It looks like you're working, so I'm going to let you go first.
I'm sorry, I'm not kidding, thank you.
Welcome, thanks for coming.
Children of booster seat age. So this issue is near and dear to my heart, and I teach it very often. I strongly support the Senate Bill 367, but I also encourage you to include all passengers of all ages in this bill. I think it is pertinent for us to send a consistent message across the state to include the safe transportation of our children, especially from ages 0 to 6 years of age. Motor vehicle crashes continue to be the primary cause of injury and death to children ages 0 to 14. Let's protect our children across the board and not just over the age of 6 in commercially owned vehicles. To facilitate this process, I do strongly recommend that parents or caregivers are responsible for providing the appropriate child restraint system. By child restraint system, I mean a device that is approved for that child at that age that meets the Oregon law, that also meets best practice for that child. This would be similar to the parents or caregivers transporting them in their own private or friends' vehicles. It would also help to reduce from the commercial providers, help to reduce their liability. It's very difficult to provide some type of rental or loaner program for child restraint systems. It's difficult to track the history. Even a small crash can compromise the integrity of a child restraint system. There may not be any visible marks on the child restraints, and so we will not know if the children or if the restraint has been in a crash or not, and it needs to be reported and removed from the system if this does happen, and often that will not occur. I can probably state fairly certainly that would not occur when you're transporting a large number of passengers. Additionally, I think that by including passengers of all ages in the Senate bill, we would encourage the commercial companies, transportation companies, to provide adequate seating positions for all passengers and adequate and fully functioning lap shoulder belts for our passengers so the parents or caregivers can properly install their child restraint systems. Again, I encourage you to send a consistent message and include the children from ages 0 to 6. I am happy to answer any questions on this. And just to follow up on something that was talked about earlier, on the transportation, the National Transportation Safety Board has urged the FAA to ban the lap children, children being held under the age of 2. They have put it on the 10 most wanted safety improvements, and they are encouraging the FAA to require parents to purchase seats on airplanes for their children. What does this mean? It means that parents and families will be traveling with child restraint systems for their children at that age, and they will have them when they arrive in Oregon at their destination point. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Franks. Questions? Thank you very much. Okay, our last two signed up, I'm going to ask Jeanette Thiebert and Elliot Eckey, who I see has come in. If you would come up, the two of you, I would appreciate it very much. It looks like you're working, so I'm going to let you go first.
I'm sorry, Mr. Davey, thank you.
Welcome. Thanks for coming.
Chairman and Honor Committee, thank you for allowing me the time today to provide a bit of perspective. My name is Jeanette Thiebert. I'm an owner-operator of an independent cab with Radio Cab Company. I actually happen to be a night driver. So some of the questions that you asked previously, I'd be happy to shed simply personal perspective on my experience. Let me preface with a couple things. Seatbelts are incredibly valuable. I couldn't agree more, okay? I'm the daughter of an individual who went through a coma for over a month, came out of that with significant paralysis. I'm the sibling of an individual who broke their neck. The seatbelt was not secured and used properly. I'm the sweetheart of someone who survived a crash that, while complications in that, crushed 6+ ribs and has one and a little bit left of a lung. Okay, as opposed to two that most of us get. Okay? I agree. They're incredibly valuable, useful tools. I also agree that given my profession and what I'm called upon to do, there are occasions when not using a seatbelt for me personally is as much a valuable tool in getting my passengers and myself safely to our prospective destinations. Okay? And I'd be happy to give you a couple of examples of that. I had the experience, I never thought I'd be sharing this with you when I thought of speaking a few days ago. But the night before last, okay, I picked up a gentleman. Now, this was not a flagged order, okay? This came through dispatch. I picked up a gentleman downtown Portland in the wee hours, about 3 a.m. About 35 or so. And he chatted, and within the first 20 blocks or so, a pleasant conversation, okay? I was taking him, of all places, to Hillsboro, my hometown. Look for you then, okay? So, about the time I start approaching the on-ramp to Highway 26, I'm noticing certain things such as little body gestures shifting, and he's a little uncomfortable. Okay. What happened then changed a number of things for me. I pulled over as opposed to getting on the freeway. But I can tell you that the story would be significantly different if I had continued on the freeway, because then I would have been in traffic making totally different decisions. Okay. I listen to him. I'm hearing, why don't you just stop here? Just stop. Just let me out. Just stop here. Okay? I pulled over and said, no, pardon me. What's going on for you? What's happening that in the last 3 minutes that was different than 5 minutes ago? And this is what I heard. Gosh, you're great. I like you. You're kind of good. Just let me up. No. And then he says, huge information I get. He says, I was hoping they'd send me just any cab driver, just any ordinary cab driver, because I can't do to you what I've intended to. I was stationary when I heard those words. Getting out of the cab was a whole lot easier than if I'd been doing 55 down the freeway. I actually practice how quickly I can bail out of a vehicle. Because A, I'm clumsy, okay, and B, I've got this restraint that comes across my lap over the shoulder, and it's got this arm. So if I ever had to get out, who's hung up in it? Of course, we don't. The seatbelt goes this way, the door goes this way. I have two things, okay? Again, I have a family member with, you know, significant issues with brain swelling and trauma and such. I appreciate what the people who spoke here today do. Some people, so what happened was we renegotiated because he had shared with me that in essence he had criminal intent. Okay? What happens was I found out it actually wasn't bodily intent to harm me. It was more financial. He meant to harm me financially. Okay? Oftentimes getting out of a situation is equally as valuable an option for me as what, in the sense of fight or flight, flight is a hopeful thing as easily as what fighting. I've also had passengers who, for one reason or another, panic or such, and actually I had a woman who, I'm not sure what happened. I didn't detect. Now, I worked in drug and alcohol treatment. I've been a social worker. Okay. Immediately prior to driving a cab. Okay. Picked up a woman. Again, dispatched order. Did not notice any type of behavior that would cause me to red flag this order. Okay. She's in the cab. Ironically, I'm approaching I-5. And something triggered her panic. And now she's trying to open the door. And I hit the door locks. And now she's trying to crawl out the window. Because I didn't have my lap belt on at that time, I could restrain her enough to keep a more horrendous event from happening till I could pull over and allow her out at a safe distance. Because of verbal cues, she was not responding to. Okay? I describe what I do as, to a degree, I pick up culturally, socially acceptable hitchhikers and take them safely to their destination. There's a lot of pride in that. There's a lot of pride in being the designated driver. You know, there are also a lot of circumstances. I also take, I think one of the issues that's come up as far as child restraint, okay? Oftentimes, my observation is individuals coming into PDX often have the ability or the means to bring an appropriate child safety seat, okay, and then plan ahead. However, the individual parent who relies on mass transit, who's now going to the grocery store and has three children in tow and is calling a cab because they can't handle three kids and a month's worth of groceries at the beginning of the month, probably also can't handle carrying three child safety seats, or even one at that point. And so it may be a socioeconomic issue as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kiefer. Questions? Thank you. Mr. Ecke.
Good morning. I'm Elliot Ecke, Public Affairs Director for AAA Oregon. I'm going to keep this very brief. You've heard all of these statistics and the reasons for, and I would say that we also endorse this bill as written. The one thing that I would mention is that as you consider this, please keep the general public safety as your first consideration. And when you made the comment, when Senator Deckard made the comment about the cab drivers in Mexico, let me tell you, in my experience, This is not intended to denigrate the cab drivers of Portland, but I have been in some cabs here in Portland and many cabs in San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and in New York. And I've got to tell you, they are some of the most aggressive drivers I've seen. I remember taking a cab ride from San Francisco International to downtown, and I looked at the speedometer. We were doing 90 miles an hour. And I learned that it was because at San Francisco International, the cab drivers have an agreement of sorts that if you pick up a fare at the airport and you can be back in line within 30 minutes, you get to move back into the lead group rather than sitting at the tail end of the line. And so this cab driver obviously was trying to beat the 30-minute limit. And I understand that there's a certain amount of economics involved here, that a lot of us who get into a strange city and know nothing about where we are or how we want to get to where we're going, jump in a cab and discover that we're only three blocks from that location. The cab driver's not too excited about making a $2 fare and spending a half hour doing it. But again, the overriding issue in this case, I believe, is the safety of the passengers, of the driver, and the other motorists on the freeways and streets. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rickey. Any questions? Senator Deckard.
Well, no, Mr. Chair, just a comment to the driver. Thank you for coming. I think it's sometimes difficult to share personal stories, but I think your testimony was helpful to us as we deliberate on this.
Concur with that. I think, members, what we'll do here, I'm getting the sense that we have a pretty good consensus in support of this bill, but there are some issues that we still need to resolve and have a further discussion on. So I think we will do that. We will be bringing this bill back and discussing the kind of the periphery issues that have been brought up today and see if there's a way that we should modify this, keeping in mind the overall issue, in which Mr. Ecke just pointed out, is, you know, overall public safety. Can we advance the bar from where we are today? And I think we've got a framework to do that, but I think we need to discuss this a little bit further. So with that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 367. And what I'm going to do now is open a public hearing on Senate Bills 259 and 196 and ask Bill Cross and his guests to come forward. Welcome. What I'd like to do is they're separate but related issues, so if we could kind of speak on both of them as you would like to organize it, Mr. Cross, that would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here representing the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association and the Oregon Society of Association Management. If you would, why don't we address Senate Bill 196 first, because the landscape contractors are here, and I appreciate the time they've taken to come and help talk about the need for the legislation. It was introduced, in fact, at their request, the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, which is a organization of landscape contractors, not to be confused within the Landscape Contractors Board. The Landscape Contractors Board is the regulatory agency that obviously does the licensure and enforcement of the related laws. Included in the testimony that I'm passing out is both a statement in support of the bill from the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association and then a statement in support of the by the Landscape Contractors Board. I'd like John Golista, who is the president of the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, to go ahead and talk a little bit about the legislation.
Thank you.
Please. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Metzger and board. Thank you for your time. I'm a Washington County resident. I own Professional Grounds Management. Our trucks say PGM. We've been commercial maintenance and landscape installation for 10 years. We are located in the western Washington County area, and we service the entire metro county. All of our trucks are lettered and have our license number on them. I feel it helps promote the professionalism of our industry, and I worked pretty hard to pass my competency test and to get the bond and the insurances to ensure my customers that we do reputable work. Therefore, I fully support this bill, and we've worked hard in NOLCA to try to bring it up to everyone's attention.
Also with us is Lee Stevenson, Vice President of the Association.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks, Bill. Just coattailing on what John said, we think the identification would be a consumer protection, allowing people to know who's on their site and have that identified by their state license, which is a readily ascertainable fact that would make it easier to know who's there. So,
Mike, go. Mr. Chair, committee members, the bill is, almost all of the landscape contractors already have the name of their company and the licensure number on their trucks. Right now, they're required, whenever they advertise, to include their license number in their advertisement. And, of course, most of them identify their trucks, that is advertising, and so most of them are in compliance, but this would help from an enforcement standpoint. The LCB does contract with investigators around the state, and if indeed all landscape contractors who are out at the job sites, at least, are required to have the signage, then presumably any truck that's out there doing landscaping work, not official, you know, not with the signage, would be would present an opportunity for the enforcement of the bill in terms of whether or not that business is performing activities that they need to be licensed and bonded for or not. If they're doing maintenance work, obviously they're not required to, but if they're doing installations, sprinkler installations, other activities that are required under the licensure, then they would not be in compliance. And one of the reasons that we have licensure and bonding is landscaping, if any of you have done any lately or had any done lately, is now, I mean, it's pretty expensive. And plants, trees, shrubs, grass, sprinkler installations, a lot of the arbors, decks, I mean, you're talking about, you know, fairly significant costs. And so when there are consumer issues that do occur occasionally, you'll have them, the LCB, able to moderate or mediate those. And if they're not resolved satisfactorily, well, then we have the bond that can cover any consumer issues.
Mr. Cross, are there other contractor organizations that have those requirements in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, no. Other contractor groups do have to have their license number and name of the business anytime they do advertising. They have to do the same thing that the landscape contractors do, but no other license group that we're aware of actually is required then to have the license number and name of the business on their trucks. That would be optional. I did attach the information from Westchester County in New York, where they're requiring vehicles to have the signage. There may be other states that require it. We didn't explore that, but in talking to the CCB, I did find out that anytime there's advertising, they do have to include their license number, but it's not a requirement that they have to have it on their trucks.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Mark Henderson.
Are there, is this to prevent people from just putting a trailer on the back of their pickup and the landscapers. I'm wondering what the problem. Can you describe if there is a problem, what problem this bill would fix?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moniz.
I know you explained a little bit on it.
There are, although this doesn't get to landscape maintenance issues, because there are consumer issues with that as well, this does get to on the contracting side, which is the new installations of sod, of shrubs, trees, but it's in conjunction with new installations. There are, that's one of the reasons why the whole licensure program was evolved, because there were problems, consumer problems with unprofessional work, and with contractors who weren't bonded, weren't financially secured, didn't have insurance, who sometimes moved from community to community and did cause serious caused serious significant financial damages to consumers. So that was one of the reasons why years ago the landscape contractors worked with the Construction Contractors Board at that time to develop the whole licensure, and in this case, a competency test. Unlike many of the CCB groups that are licensed or registered with CCB, where they have to take and pass an examination based on their knowledge of independent contracting laws, business laws, that type of thing, this is actually a competency test on all the installation services that they can perform, everything from building decks to paving walkways to sod, fertilizers, pesticides, shrubs.
Approximately 450 questions.
So the reason you need this bill, because there is a problem, I guess I'm trying to get at, do you have reports of really abuse where there are people performing work that shouldn't be performing work? I mean, do you have data on that? Is it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moniz Anderson, unfortunately, Mike Snyder, the administrator for the Licensed Contractors Board, is in Bend for a conference. Wasn't able to attend, and his assistant is mediating today a claim, so I couldn't get either of them here. But according to Mike Snyder, there are about seven cases a month filed regarding landscape contracting issues. Landscape maintenance, because they don't really, since they don't license landscape maintenance operations or businesses, they don't really know how many problems there are out there, but they do get phone calls in addition to the installation. They do get phone calls on maintenance. They don't really, because they don't have the responsibility to regulate that area, I don't really know how many they get, and I don't know if they maintain those records. They probably do, and I'm sorry I didn't get that information.
But follow up. So of those seven complaints per month, that's due to people who aren't maybe correctly licensed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moniz Anderson, either who weren't properly licensed and performed the work, or who may have been properly licensed and the customer was not satisfied with the work and is seeking some sort of assistance from the board to resolve that issue.
One quick question, just in general, the one maintenance company that goes around and mows lawn is not registered to, or not necessary to register or become a licensed landscape contractor. What happens if the homeowner asks them to, could you please dig up this rose bush and replant it over there since you're going to be here on Thursday? Does that person then in jeopardy or in violation of the law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, Not at this point. There is an exemption of up to $500 per customer, so to speak, and so somebody doing maintenance work who may do some casual installation of that nature wouldn't be in violation of the landscape contractor's licensure law. But if they did more than $500 for a, you know, a business, right, annually, exactly. So if they've got a licensed, a maintenance contract, and we have landscape maintenance companies as well that are members of OLCA, but if they're doing maintenance and they have agreement, a yearly agreement, you know, with a company and they're providing services, and they're not licensed as a contractor, and they do an occasional, that's acceptable. I mean, they're not required to become licensed and that type of thing. But if they made it a habit of, you know, if they were going to do a big installation project for somebody, if they're doing the maintenance and now they want to, you know, expand and put in some fountains or, you know, an underground sprinkler system, that would be against the licensure requirements.
Questions? Okay. With that, I think we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 196. And, gentlemen, thank you for coming. Mr. Cross, let's have a public hearing on Senate Bill 259.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, again, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. On this particular bill, I'm representing the Oregon Society of Association Management. That's an organization of nonprofit organizations. Their association managers typically join. I, besides providing lobbying services, have four associations that I provide association management services for. Because I kind of lobby, I'm typically the legislative committee chair for OSAM because nobody else wants to do it. However, they asked the legislature to and introduce this bill to allow boards of directors of nonprofit organizations to conduct business electronically. And in Oregon, it's not legal to do that. It is for boards of directors of private corporations. We simply have not asked for that permission. As our organizations have become, you know, more technologically driven, as our volunteers, frankly, find it more difficult to commit the kind of time that you used to get out of volunteers. So getting them to attend regularly, monthly or quarterly board meetings, especially if you're a statewide association and they're spread out geographically, it's getting more and more difficult. So a lot of us organizations are moving more and more towards electronic meetings, teleconference board meetings, committee meetings that are conducted through electronic means. But technically, if a board of directors were to electronically conduct business, they wouldn't. It wouldn't be, you know, legal. And so we'd like to ask that you go ahead and permit nonprofit boards to do this, and let us move into the 21st century, so to speak.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 196, and gentlemen, thank you for coming. Mr. Cross, let's have a public hearing on Senate Bill 259.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, again, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. On this particular bill, I'm representing the Oregon Society of Association Management. That's an organization of nonprofit organizations. Their association managers typically join. I, besides providing lobbying services, have four associations that I provide association management services for. Because I kind of lobby, I'm typically the legislative committee chair for OSAM because nobody else wants to do it. However, they asked the legislature to and introduce this bill to allow boards of directors of nonprofit organizations to conduct business electronically. And in Oregon, it's not legal to do that. It is for boards of directors of private corporations. We simply have not asked for that permission. As our organizations have become, you know, more technologically driven, as our volunteers, frankly, find it more difficult to commit the kind of time that you used to get out of volunteers. So getting them to, attend regularly, monthly or quarterly board meetings, especially if you're a statewide association and they're spread out geographically, it's getting more and more difficult. So a lot of us organizations are moving more and more towards electronic meetings, teleconference board meetings, committee meetings that are conducted through electronic means. But technically, if a board of directors were to electronically conduct business, they wouldn't, it wouldn't be, you know, legal. And so we'd like to ask that you go ahead and permit nonprofit boards to do this and let us move into the 21st century, so to speak.
Okay, so Mr. Cross, this doesn't change in any way the bylaws of any organization in terms of how they participate and how they keep their minutes. It's only in allowing participation electronically.
Mr. Chair, actually, many organizations would have to modify their bylaws to,
that was my question. My
to
question
allow
was.
That. It wouldn't require them, in other words, to conduct electronic.
Right.
And if they wanted to do so, most of them would have to go back, revisit their bylaws, because...
Right. It's permissible.
But it would be permissible.
That's my question.
Yes, that's correct.
Any questions?
Work session, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Close the public hearing, open a work session. Our first one, Senate Bill 259.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
I move Senate Bill 259 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 259 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? It's ordered. And I think we'll ask Senator Monis Anderson, new member, to be the first carrier for the Senate Business Committee. Thank you very much, Mr. Cross. As we conclude our business, I'd like to ask the Mayor Forrest Groves. I understand he's been waiting patiently. We'd love to have a greeting from you. So please come forward.
Thank you very much, Chairman Metzger. My name is Richard Kidd. I'm the mayor of Forest Grove. I was intending to be here a little early, but we have had 19 million some dollars worth of requests for community development block grant, and those the recommendations close tonight and tomorrow on those, and I had to go separate those out. Obviously, we don't have that much money to give the people in the county, so that was my chore, and I was a little late getting here. I would like to refer back to some of the testimony that was given to you earlier and comments by the mayor of Hillsborough and let you know that the testimony from Hillsborough and the testimony from North Plains, I concur with most of their comments for you. I'd like to tell you about Forest Grove. Forest Grove is a small town, university town, and I came to Forest Grove 30 years ago for a one-year military assignment and haven't left. So it's a very nice place to live and to raise children, and the home of Pacific University. So it's a university town. It has grown from the 5,600 residents when I came here 30 years ago to a Christmas present this year of 20,000. Which is significant growth. In 1973, we worked on Senate Bill 100. We started working on land use values for Oregon. We established an urban growth boundary, and the urban growth boundary in Hillsborough and Forest Grove were established by means of a grease pencil and a helicopter and a map originally. And when Craig, at that time, we landed in
the then city manager for Hillsborough said, this is what I want, and the then mayor and city manager of Forest Grove said, this is what I want, and they convinced Forest Grove to move that boundary back to its city limits, in relatively city limits in 1974-75 time frame, with the promise, of course, that whenever you need that urban growth boundary expanded, no problem, just ask for it and you'll get it. We went on and formed a regional government, Metro, which has done a tremendous job, and they've done a lot of things, but they have, as the Honorable Mayor from Hillsborough mentions, have a tendency to just creep a little bit into those things that local jurisdictions have thought were their territory, so to speak. Forest Grove is a very diverse community. It was originally agro-based. Right now we have electronics. We have high-tech industry. We have one of the major agro businesses in Washington County. Several of them, as a matter of fact, cold storage, food processors, are still in our community. So it's a major portion of our economy. The economy is beginning to suffer tremendously in the fact that Forest Grove, 28% of the land mass inside the city is non-taxable, with the university, the sewer district, and public buildings and spaces. When we completely annex to our urban growth boundary, we will be 30% of our signature untaxable. So it's very important to us that we work very diligently on producing some tax base in order to continue the prosperity of our community in the future. We look at the order of taking land into the urban growth boundary, and we look at the rules of Goal 14, which was mentioned earlier, and Goal 9, and they talk about the fact that jurisdictions, counties, and regions. So when you draw the boundary and become a region, you lose some of your autonomy as a jurisdiction, because the region then is looked at for those things such as land use and expansion of industrial base. So in Forest Grove, on the south side and on the east side, we have a floodplain. On the on the west side, on the east side, we have the city of Cornelius, and on the north, we have exclusive use farmland. So there is no place for us to expand except into farmland. If, in fact, the city of Forest Grove and Cornelius chose to or had justification to meet the 20-year land supply, and they could justify that for any base, the land supply would have to be under the hierarchy of land, would have to be filled with exception lands first, and then on up the chain until you got to the farmland. And in the region, there is exception land that could take industry. It's in Damascus and places 42 miles away from where the actual need has occurred. So the legislature and LCDC have both put into place tools that would solve the problem if they were used correctly. That sub-regional division of Metro allow them to look at land on a sub-regional basis, and they do have the authority to do that, to create five regions of any population of 50,000 with a minimum population of 50,000, and they have chose not to do that for the last 4 or 5 years, which puts us at risk. And Forest Grove and Cornelius are an island. We're not really in the same contiguous boundary for Metro. Metro's boundary stops at the west side of Hillsborough. There is a large, a mile and a half, 2 miles of agricultural land, and then there's another urban growth boundary around Forest Grove and Cornelius, but it's still Metro's urban growth boundary, and it's considered in the overall picture. I don't know whether I can ask you to do some legislation that would make Forest Grove and Cornelius boundary be one that would be considered separately as a sub-region. Between the two cities, we're still not at 50,000, so that's out there. I would like to say some other things. Is enough on that. Forest Grove has sufficient water to last us for the next 50 or 60 years, including expansion. We have our own utility electrical district, and we have the lowest water and electric rate in the state, and we have sufficient to support industry. We have no certified sites on the state's industrial certified program. I have three sites of less than 25 acres or less that are being considered now for certification as a shovel-ready site. I have lost three industries in the last 2 years, one with 280 jobs that moved to North Carolina, and one industry that didn't move to North Carolina. They chose not to come here and relocate in North Carolina, and another defense industry that moved to Huntsville, Alabama. And I have physically lost three businesses out of Forest Grove in the last year and a half. Davis Tool, which purchased the Fujitsu building in Hillsboro and moved to Hillsboro. A metal fabrication company that went out of business manufacturing stainless steel tanks, and all because of their ability not to ship, be able to ship them over road networks and the oversize over length on a road network, and one food processor that chose to move to another location, and our largest electronic industry, which had some land in Forest Grove, chose to move to expand still in Oregon, but in the Gresham area. So they chose to do that, and their reason there was the lack of adequate labor force, and then specifically transportation, in that TriMet light rail does not service Forest Grove and Cornelius at this time. It is scheduled for 2017, but we're trying to accelerate that. Sir, I'm available for any questions that you might have, and I appreciate very much you having to get in. I know you have a very tight schedule and another agenda to make.
Well, thank you very much for being so patient with us. Any questions for the mayor? Senator Becker.
You know, it's just a comment, but it's more, I guess, for our committee. Is I'm beginning to think Metro is in need of reform more and more every day that I'm here, because I just hear from all these cities that are having a really difficult time conducting their business, and Metro seems to be one of the chief impediments to housing, to industrial land, and so I don't know what bills are in play, but I find myself more receptive day after day on maybe sub-regional or potentially voted for last.
And I'm part of the problem, Senator Decker. I'm a member of IMPACT at Metro. So is Mayor Hughes, and so is Mayor Drake. We're part of their advisory committee. We're 3 out of 33 votes.
Uh-huh.
Things like requiring the small cities to do report on affordable housing that takes them a professional consultant 40 to 80 hours to do this report on affordable housing, and if they don't get the report in, they're eliminated from any funding or any ability to apply for grants for transportation issues.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
Come on. So we've got that to the point where the new chair of IMPACT this past Wednesday put the gavel down and said, okay, these small jurisdictions that do not have staff, do not have professional staff to do that, can meet that requirement by giving me a 2-page letter telling me what they're doing for affordable housing in their community, what tools they're giving for affordable housing for their community, and we'll exempt that report. And the counselors were not 100% pleased with that, but they've accepted that recommendation from IMPACT to do that, just that one report, for instance. It's quite extensive, as just on affordable housing.
Just, Mr. Chairman, I know Senator Steyer wants to get in. It's just one other comment. Maybe we just need to get them back to their mission. They have a distinct mission that I think was pretty limited, and maybe that's the, I don't know how you just really tighten that up, but get them back to that core mission.
Maybe at that mission creep we heard about earlier.
That's right. Yeah. That's Mayor Hughes' favorite thing is mission creep, and I had them around I'm also on the advisory board for LCDC, which I was there yesterday, and they discussed the issue of some of the things for Goal 14, and I think that LCDC next week will probably provide as best fix they can without being in conflict with ORSs. So,
Senator Stark?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mayor Kidd, for sticking with us and having the opportunity to testify. Mr. Chair and my colleagues up here, this I think is the clearest example you can draw of the interplay between land use and transportation, quite frankly, with economic development. And as you've heard from the cities that I represent here in Western Washington County, the biggest, biggest impediment to economic development in Western Washington County really is land use policy. And the biggest impediment to local control of land use policy that the cities that I represent run into day in and day out is not state statute, but it's Metro and Metro's, the way Metro has gone about doing the things that it's done. And I've have in the hopper several ideas about ways to correct, I guess, that or rebalance the equation. And I'll be hopefully working with all of you to accomplish some of those really minor tweaks, not overall, you know, throwing out the whole thing, but there are some definite issues that I think that we should look at. Unfortunately, Mr. Chair, more than likely those issues won't come before this committee, though we could argue they make a lot of sense on the economic development issues front, but we'll have to work closely with our land use committee colleagues in the legislature as well.
Well, just because I'm on this side of town, this happens all over the region. I'm not really unique. I just happen to be the guy out at the end of the thing.
Representative Wright.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to, first of all, echo what Senator Starr has said. We had one of my mayors wasn't able to attend today, and I do have conversations with him, as I'm sure Senator Starr does, and I'm sure he would echo these very same sentiments, and I just wanted to say that I'm of the same opinion that we really need to rein in the creep, as it's been called. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Well, thank you all. We made a little history here today. We passed our first bill out outside the Capitol. Thank you for your attendance and sharing your wisdom with us. With that, the Senate Business Committee is adjourned.